You're listening to the WP Tonic, WordPress and Tech, focused on building a successful business in WordPress aimed at the WordPress professional and power user. Join Jonathan Denwood and Kurt Von Annen as your host and co-host as we bring you great discussions from around the globe.
Welcome back, folks, to the WP Tonic Show. This is episode 987. We've got a returning friend of the show. We've got Rob Rowling with us, the founder of Tiny Seed MicroConf and the podcast for startups for the rest of us. He's a friend of the show. It should be a great discussion. We're going to be talking, are the glory days of SaaS finished with the world of AI? And we're going to be talking about some of the other subjects that Rob's been discussing over the past few months. Should be a great show. So, Rob, would you like to give the tribe a quick 10-15 second intro? And then when we come back for the main part of the interview, you can give a longer intro.
For sure. I'm a recovering software engineer, builder, and maker. And I've started a few SaaS companies, sold a few, and now I run Tiny Seed, which is an accelerator for B2B SaaS companies, and MicroConf, which is a community for B2B SaaS founders.
That's fantastic. And I've got my great co-host, Kurt. Kurt, would you like to introduce yourself to the new listeners and viewers?
Sure thing, Jonathan. My name is Kurt Von Annen. I own an agency called Manana Nomas, and we work directly with the great team over at WP Tonic.
That's fantastic. Before we go into the meat and potatoes of this great show, this great interview, I've got a message from one of our major sponsors. We will be back in a few moments, folks.
Hey, running a business is tough. You shouldn't have to worry about your website, too. With Kinsta's managed hosting for WordPress, you get lightning-fast load times, enterprise-grade security, and 24/7 expert support from real humans. Switch to Kinsta and see site speeds improve by up to 200% with effortless migrations and powerful, easy-to-use dashboard. Join over 120,000 other businesses who also trust Kinsta. Get your first month for free at Kinsta.com. That's Kinsta.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
We're coming back. We also got a monthly sponsor, and Kurt is going to tell you something about them. Over to you, Kurt.
Well, Jonathan, we are still happy to have Mysterio with us, Mysterio LMS. They have not just a trial version. It's not trial. It's 100% free. So it's free and it's unlimited, no credit card required. When we say unlimited, it's unlimited courses, unlimited students, and it does have the availability for payment gateways all in the free version. If you wanted to have something like certificates or content drip, they have some pro features available, but you could get more at MysterioLMS.com. That's MysterioLMS.com.
That's fantastic. Well, Rob, thanks for agreeing to come back on the show again. They're always great discussions. I think you enjoy them. That's why you agreed to come back. So maybe for the new listeners and viewers, and we've had quite a few new people joining the tribe, maybe you can give us a more detailed how you got into software as an engineer. Because I think your origins were electrical engineering. Am I correct about that?
Yeah. Yep. And then I worked construction for a few years, but I had learned to code as a kid, as many of us do. You pick up a book, How to Speak Basic to My Apple, and I just kind of typed in some basic into the old Apple IIe, and it really kind of fit the way my mind worked. So I've been working construction, and there was one day where I was literally sitting in a ditch being rained on with a shovel, and it was a backhoe, and we were trying to lay, you know, pipe for electrical wiring. And I thought to myself, what the heck am I doing here? Like, why am I not doing something in an office? Because I could like see in the window and see the people in there. And I was like, I want to get an office job. Maybe I'll learn to code again. So I went to the library nights and weekends, learned to code. And then that was so much fun for a few years. And then it's, you know, you work for one credit card company, you work for the city of Pasadena, you work, and it's like, this isn't fun anymore. So then I realized I should be an entrepreneur and I should start my own stuff. And so about 20 years ago, I started launching them, and it took me about 4 or 5 years to have enough income for my own products to, to be out on my own. And since then, I've started a total of 6 companies, including Tiny Seed and MicroConf. And 5 of those companies were bootstrapped. And Tiny Seed is the one we've raised funding for.
So where was you born? What area was it?
In California.
In California.
Yeah, I was born in the East Bay of California, which is like Silicon Valley, right? I actually worked in Sunnyvale and San Jose, the heart of it. And I knew precisely zero people in the tech industry. Mm. All I knew was like my family and construction. And it was in a very much, I'm still an outsider. Like I can't ring up venture capitalists. They don't know who I am. I just had to like do this on my own. The reason I didn't raise funding for my previous companies is I didn't know anyone with money. I didn't know any investors. And so I've always felt, first I felt like an outsider and that was a bad thing. And now I feel like an outsider and I'm okay with that. You know, it's like I kind of had to build my own community and build my own group of folks that all feel a little bit like misfits, which is kind of how I've always felt compared to the broader startup ecosystem.
So what did you do, mommy? Asking, what did your dad and mom do then?
Yeah, my dad was an electrician.
He was an electrician.
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't own the business, but I mean, he was an electrician and then a project manager, 42 years in the construction industry. And that's what my older brother does still. He runs a contractor out there. And so he and I often talk about the path not, like his path not taken is not getting into tech because he and I both learned how to code around the same age. And I'm glad that I got out of it.
So what led to getting, you know, as a child coding? Because your dad was your family, your dad or anybody in your family into it and they influenced you?
No, but like my dad had seen computers around the office. This is the early 80s. My dad had seen computers around the office and kind of said, that's the future. So we're going to buy one for you kids for Christmas, just so you know how to use one. How do you learn how to type? You didn't learn how to type that in the 80s. And then we got one book that was about programming and we couldn't afford. So back then it was like a game. Like a game that was kind of crappy to play, low 8-bit, was like $50. So that'd be like, what, $150 today? $125? It'd be a lot of money with inflation. And we didn't have that kind of money with a single working parent. And so we got this book and you could type in your own games. Now they were text games, right? It was kind of like Zork, like Infocom games. But so that's what it was like. We did it to stay entertained. We lived out in the country. We didn't have anybody that lived within miles of us. And we just read a lot of books, played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons, and programmed the computer and played the games we had, but then we decided we got to build our own to stay entertained.
So this ditch incident, and you decided you try and learn programming. What was the first language that you learned then?
I had known BASIC, and this is, when was this? 1999, 2000. And I went to the library that night, and I'm like, I knew HTML. I had learned HTML in college. And I was like, what language do I need to know to web program? And it was classic ASP and Perl, CGI scripts. And then PHP, I think, was just coming about. And I was like, oh, PHP is so nice compared to Perl. Like, I don't know if you guys ever did CGI scripts. It was brutal. You just take it in and string processing and stuff. So that was an early thing. And I applied to a few jobs and I wound up getting a job in Sacramento with just the little knowledge that I had. And that was when I got good at programming, was doing it 40 or 50 hours a week for the first time in my life.
And what company was that? Do you mind me asking?
It was a consulting firm called Paradox Concepts. And it was like a 20-person firm in Sacramento. And talk about outsourcing or offshoring or nearshoring. Like all the Bay Area companies would hire us because we were like 25% cheaper than the Bay Area companies, or 30% because we were in Sacramento and it was cheaper to live. And so salaries were lower. And so, yeah, our boss, the CEO, would drive into the Bay Area, sell a $30,000, $50,000 project to build a web app. You know, it was .com boom. We were working for .coms in that first wave. And then we would go build it.
All right. Over to you, Kurt.
I am listening to you talk, Rob, and I'm having like wild flashbacks. I got hired by Ducati and drugged to California to work at Ducati's main offices, which at the time was right across the street from Apple in Cupertino. And my wife has family in Elk Grove. And I just don't know that listeners and viewers like really have a tactile understanding of just like what a foreign planet that whole Silicon Valley space is. Like when I would drive to the office, people would stop in the middle of the street and like share their phone screens with people as if they're like not in the street. Like, it's a totally bizarre place to live. And when you describe yourself as like an outlier or outside of that space, I'm going to say when you said that just now, it kind of shocked me because I always looked Like I read your book. Thanks for sending me the book, by the way, the SaaS Playbook. I think listeners and viewers picture you like being this inside guy, but then you just described yourself as not the inside guy. Could you kind of just expand like on what that feels like there? Because I think that's unique. People might think that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's trippy to grow up in a place and to not feel like I could take advantage of, there were all these startups around me. And I was like, well, I want to be part of this. It's exciting. It's interesting. There's money flowing. There are people are building stuff. I'm a creator. I'm a maker. I want to do it. And to just be like, I don't know anyone who does this. And like, I did apply to jobs in the Bay Area in that 99-2000 timeframe. And I just couldn't, well, any of the jobs that I got offered, they were paying, you just couldn't, you can't even afford an apartment there. Like $2,000 a month at the time didn't even pay for a one bedroom apartment. You know, it's crazy. And so the thing that I started wrestling with was like, I don't know that I want to go down this venture capital. Everyone was like, if you want to do anything in software, you just raise funding. And it was like, well, A, how do you do that? Like, how do you raise funding? I don't know anyone. And B, what if I want to do it without doing that? And that became the question. No one was talking about that except for Joel Spolsky. He started in 2000, 2001. He had a consulting, like an agency, and then he was spinning products off Fogbugs and a few others. Later, Trello came out of it and Stack Overflow, right? Stack Exchange. But that was my feeling of, I guess if I'm an outsider, maybe I'll just walk my own path because I'm an outsider no matter what. You know what I mean? There was this whole path of VC and it's like, nobody knows me there. Maybe I'll just invent this path of bootstrapping. I didn't invent it, you get it, but I had never heard of anyone doing it. So I was kind of inventing it in my head of, can't I just build software and just charge people for it? And that became the path. And then I started blogging about that in 05. And that was where like an audience started building up of like, wait, I'm also a developer who doesn't know anyone who would give them funding. How do you have $3,000 a month in product revenue, you know? And it's like, well, here's what I did. And that became the start of all of this, of the books. I'm 5 books in now, you know, in terms of publishing and the podcast and everything kind of sprang out of that. Just originally, it was just sharing my journey and what I was doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, my head just exploded. I used to travel up and down Highway 9 to go to Boulder Creek because when I got the offer at Ducati, I thought, that's a lot of money. And then I went to California. I said, we can't afford to live. So I had to drive to the top of the mountain every day.
Yeah, it is. It's brutal. People don't realize how bad the cost of living is out there. My parents are still out there and I go see them every now and again. And I'm like, oh, California's, it's nice, but there's a lot of some issues. Now I live in Minneapolis, which is like, it's just a higher quality of life, although it's very cold here.
Yeah. Well, that kind of leads us to our next question. And that is, so in this new sea of artificial intelligence, right? And you're talking about startups and all the things that you do. Can a SaaS still be successful coming out of the chute?
For sure. Yeah, we see it every day. You know, we do Tiny Seed. We do applications twice a year. We're an accelerator. And so we do a batch of companies at a time, usually 10 to sometimes upwards of 15 at one time every 6 months. And so when we do this application process, we get hundreds and hundreds of applicants. And then we fund, you know, 2-2.5% of them. And we are still seeing SaaS companies that started 6 months ago, that started 2 years ago, some that started more than that, but that are getting traction. And the key is, how do you use AI to help augment? AI helps you move faster. AI is not a competitive advantage because everyone can use it. So there is no advantage. It's only an advantage if your competitors are not using it, but it is an accelerant, right? It helps you get there faster. And so integrating it into your, whether it's your product, whether it's your internal operations, whether it's growth and marketing, these things can help you. It is getting noisier. Marketing's getting noisier. There are more SaaS companies and AI is not making this any easier on people, but we definitely still see a lot of winners.
Nice. Jonathan?
Well, you kind of hinted that. Isn't though just the level of competition just, you know, the ability to no code, you know, lovable, you know, I think it's a bit overdone myself. I've got a friend and she was one of the first employees of Evernote and she's had a few successful launches and she hates WordPress with a passion. And she said, you know, but she said, well, you can almost knock anything up in lovable and it's only going to get easier. Isn't it just the amount of competition in the SaaS space? And isn't it, the only thing I was thinking I was going to ask you, isn't it, isn't it just become really possible just to have a kind of custom solution through AI, you know, just have something custom for your individual needs and not have to use a SaaS, really?
Yes and no. The answer is, at least the way I view it, is when no code started really coming up, when you had Bubble and Airtable, and Zapier's been around forever, but, you know, as you could start building things with drag and drop builders, people said, this is it. It's the end of code. You're just going to build everything in no code. And then some people said no code isn't going to be for anything. You know, you're not going to use it for anything. And it's like, neither of those is true. What happened is no code probably took 10% of the SaaS market, maybe 15, 20, right? There are fewer people paying for SaaS because they can build it. Internally with TinySeed and MicroConf, we have at least three full-blown line of business internal apps that we have built in Airtable. I'd say four, like our entire TinySeed application process. You apply, we filter, we do all this, all that's in Airtable. The entire production system for my podcast and YouTube is all custom. And so we probably would have paid for something or used Google Sheets previously. And that's what no code did. I think AI will do something similar. AI coding, lovable and that kind of stuff. I think it can take 10, 15, 20% of the SaaS market. The thing is the more complicated you get, the harder it is to build, harder it is to maintain in the long term. Yeah. That's what's going to kill people. And yeah, AI is getting better, I know. But the ability to build a little utility, you know, if you were to say, I need a Chrome extension that I want to give me an alert when any website in whatever blah happens, I can build that with AI in like half an hour now. So those types of things, they're low-hanging fruit, these little utilities. If you want to convert a PDF to a JPEG to an MP3, whatever, AI. Because it's just a little, it's a little structure. It's a little, it's 20, 50, 100 lines of code. Yeah, AI going to do that. But let's talk about building Salesforce, HubSpot, building an email service provider, building DocuSign, building, I don't know, let's think of like a full-blown SaaS app that it does millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions. You can't build that with AI. You could try. It's going to be buggy as hell. The user interface is going to suck, you know. And even as AI gets better and better, I think there will always be makers who can make their stuff maintainable, better user experience, on and on.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, actually, about what do I know? You've been a lot more successful than I have been. Back over to you, Kurt.
Again, you did it to me. I'm running into a ton of like vibe coders or stories of vibe coding where they're saying, oh, I used this to build this. It was so easy. It was so great. And they're selling these products. Like they're creating businesses and selling these products. And in my mind, and maybe I'm polluted from the WordPress space where there's always an update. You know, there's always something that's got to be updated or a possible conflict with your latest page builder. And you got to fix that. Like, so I see these people building these things and they have no idea how the code works. They built it with no code and then they sell these products. I'm assuming you get a lot of exposure to these types of workflows. How are people dealing with that? Are they just like taking the money and running and changing the company name or?
Depends on the person. Yeah, it's opportunistic in the sense that these are not 5-year businesses. These might not even be 2-year businesses. It's, I'm going to build this utility. They are likely have big security flaws because it isn't so great at that. They're unmaintainable if you get past, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of lines of code. They often have bugs in them. And so the good developers, I know senior developers using AI as an augmentation and engine to get there faster and to help write, well, to write the unit tests, you know, and they go through, but they spend time. They spend 30, 60 minutes doing something that if the first pass, it's like, oof, AI did this in 5 minutes. That pass is not great. That pass is like someone who's coded for a few months. We see applicants certainly have seen an increase to TinySeed of AI generated and no code code bases. And we specifically ask that now as a question. Who wrote the code for this? It's okay if you use AI if a senior, mid-level to senior developer is using AI. But if you tell me you vibe code, and we ask in interviews, did you vibe code this? It's not a hard no, but it is a red flag for us. And in fact, in this batch alone, there was a company that we decided not to fund because we think the code base is going to have to be completely rewritten in the next 6 to 12 months. Most no code, we've backed a few no code apps. All of them have needed to be completely rewritten from scratch. And you just got to know it's not a hard no, but it definitely is a ding against you if you're.
Well, because that would completely flip the profit proposition completely upside down, because now you have the implied expense of the easy way of building it. And then when you bring in just a little bit of revenue, because they price themselves competitively, right? So they don't have a great margin to begin with, and then they have to rewrite the whole thing manually anyway. It's they're completely upside down, I would think.
They stand still is what we say. They basically, you know, if they're charging MRR and they have $3,000 of MRR, $4,000 of MRR, the MRR keeps coming in, but they have to then spend however many months to rewrite it, and they stand still, meaning they're not launching any features. And so they're either losing ground or they're just kind of flailing of like, you know, I'm now wasting all the time to do the thing I should have done up front type thing. So it's challenge and it's frustrating for them as well. Again, we've had a couple tiny seed companies that have rewritten their code base and the founders are like, I can't release new features. I'm losing customers because I can't release this feature because we're rewriting the whole thing. And I'm like, I know. And this is why we'll probably not back many more, you know, vibe coded or no code. It's not an absolute, but you get the feel. Yeah. It's a negative signal for us, you know?
Well, we were going to ask, like, what are some of the biggest mistakes in business that you could share with the tribe, you know, that you could share with our audience? Is that one of the biggest mistakes or is that like something new that hasn't come your way yet?
No, that's something new that hasn't come my way yet. It's certainly,
Can I just say one thing? We had a great interview a couple of weeks ago with Dustin from Magi. I don't know if you, am I pronouncing it correct, Kurt?
Yeah, Magi.
Have you heard of Magi?
I have not.
It's a place where he offers all the leading language models in one price, and you can. He's the experienced interface designer, UX designer, and he was running out of his money, and he built this using the no code, and he launched it. And he's been highly successful. You use it, don't you, Kurt?
Oh, yeah. I'm a subscriber. I like it because it puts all of my learning management, you know, all my LLMs in one dashboard. So I don't have to remember where I worked on stuff. All my chats are in one interface. But it gives me access to all of the major ones.
Right. Pokes is too.
He launched a lifetime deal, not on AppSumo, on another platform. And it gave him the money to move the product forward. So there's, but in general, I do agree with what you've outlined. I just thought I would just point it out because Dustin's such a nice guy, wasn't he, Kurt?
He's a sweetheart.
He's a bit like you. He hasn't been on the show as many times as you, but he's been on a few times. He's just a great founder. Sorry, Kurt, I interrupted.
No, it's all good. We're on the what are the biggest mistakes in business question.
Well, yeah, and it's like I have my own, right? I recorded a YouTube video and a podcast episode about like the biggest mistakes I've made because I get asked about this a lot, right? It's like, all right, you're successful. What did you do well, and what did you really mess up over the years? And so these might not be the biggest mistakes in business, but maybe the biggest mistakes in my story. And I'm going to just throw one out here: lifetime deals if you're SaaS. Don't do that. I'm not going to say it's the biggest mistake, but I am anti-lifetime for the reasons because SaaS is not a lifetime. If they can download it right on their own server and that's the point, good. You can give them one price, but not if you're going to maintain something month after month. But things that I did personally as I was going along and I still succeeded in spite of these things is things like launching a bunch of ideas. I'm going to launch an idea a week and just kind of see what sticks. I'm going to launch one thing after the other, but not actually focusing on something and taking feedback, iterating on it, you know, trying to find product market fit. I know that's kind of jargon, but like I see so few products that out of the gate, I mean, almost none of the 7 or 8 figure SaaS, bootstrap SaaS companies I know, launch something and it's like, oh, it took off. Like it's 1%. Or less. Everyone else, they like Drip, which was my last SaaS app. We had like 3 different iterations of it over the course of 18 months. Like we launched and it kind of worked, but it kind of wasn't. And we iterated. But something I did early on and something that's popular, kind of the end of the indie hacker scene these days is like, well, I'm going to launch 20 things in 20 weeks and just see what sticks. And it's like, that's like buying lottery tickets. Like actually put in the work and learn is, I think, a big mistake I've made.
I got thrown out of one of your groups because You remember I joined one of your groups.
What, your mastermind group?
Yeah, I got thrown out because the guy, he said he was doing that. And I said, it's a little bit too much. And it didn't go down very well. But I should have kept my mouth shut.
Lessons I've learned for sure.
Don't know about that. Well, it's a middle road, isn't it? But I think some do go a bit far on it, don't they? They kind of...
Because it's easy. It's like me saying, and it's what we all want to do. We're makers, we're builders. If you're a maker or a builder, you want to just make and build, and you don't want to do the things you don't want to do. And so if I were to tell you, Kurt, you can get in great shape, all you have to do is eat ice cream and play video games. If I convinced you that was true, you'd be like, this guy, Rob, he should be so popular. Even if it's not true, that's what I feel like. Some people are just selling this dream that's like, this is not good. I tell people, eat spinach and actually lift weights or run or whatever, you know? And like, It may be kind of the tough love, but it's what I really believe that pretty adamantly, that like, you're going to have to do some things you don't want to do. And that may include grinding on an idea for a while to see if it works and then moving on to the next one only if it fails.
I think that's the magic question that a lot of entrepreneurs get completely wrong, Rob, is I was someone that was somewhat tenacious and I would get an idea and I would follow. The whole world's telling me it's failing and I'm going, nope. I just know, just a little bit more time. And then finally I go, okay, I give up. And then a year, 2 years later, my exact concept all of a sudden has widespread adoption and everybody's railing on it, right? And so that happened to me three different times where I tried something and it failed. So finally I put together a project like 5 years ago. And again, I feel like I was early to market and I was this close to shutting it down. And literally the month I was going to turn it off, it turned profitable. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just like, so it's so hard to encourage people because there are times where people should go, okay, I've invested too much in this. I need to shut it down. But that decision is so hard. And I can only imagine if someone did 20 products in 20 weeks, trying to pick which one to shut down because you didn't give any of them a chance to succeed.
Yeah, that's right. One of the most common questions I get, especially from early stage founders, is how do I know when to quit? How do I know when to bail on an idea? How do I know if it's working or not? And usually it's, are you out of ideas of things to try and are you out of motivation? And realize we all have weaknesses and strengths. If your weakness is you don't stick with anything long enough, then you need to stick with things way longer than you think. If your weakness is you stick with stuff for too long, which I have some friends who like worked on the same startup for like 6 or 7 years with almost no traction, it's like, that's just dumb. That's just too long, right? So you kind of got to know yourself a bit, but also, sorry.
No, I've got a kind of product, but I still haven't got... I'm going to try and persuade Kirk my vision for that. But I don't know. But I think just to finish off before we go for the midterm break, I think the greatest thing, I was watching, I've got the guy's name, but he's the founder of RB2B. I don't know if you know about this product, Rob, but when somebody comes to your website, it shows...
Oh, I've heard of this.
He's very popular. And he did a video and he said, the thing I didn't realize, the key to everything, and I think you've said this a few times, is market fit. Mm. If you haven't got product market fit, you haven't got anything, have you?
That's right, because product market fit is really just, have you built something that businesses want and are willing to pay for and that they don't churn? So churn is a huge signal of product market fit and also growth. Just MRR or ARR going up into the right.
Of this guy, I wish I could remember his name, but he was saying his first SaaS, he got it over to $1 million, but he said it was a bit like a leaky bucket. This is a hardcore marketer.
Big time.
So he knows what he's doing, and he said he was smart, but it was like a leaky bucket. They were losing as many clients as they were going, and it just wasn't getting track. It seemed successful, but he realized the market fit wasn't really there. He was managing to move it forward by almost personal will.
It's like brute force. Yep. And if you're a really good marketer, you can kind of hide with top of funnel new leads. You can kind of hide your lack of retention right? If you're churning people out, but you're just refilling them, it's just not a great business. Like we actually don't fund businesses like that. Like we look at the full life cycle. It's not just growth. You can't just say, well, it's growing, therefore it's successful. That's not true. You have to look at net revenue retention over time, and you want churn to flatten out. Yeah, it's very important. It's harder than people think. Everyone who gets into SaaS, who has been like an infra product marketer or an e-commerce founder or a consultancy, an agency, it's always like, well, I want to do SaaS because it's recurring and because exit multiples are great and blah, blah, blah. And then they get in and inevitably it's like, oh no, building a product that people don't churn out of is so, so, so hard. And most founders never get there.
Right. I think that's a good place for our break. We got a couple of messages from the sponsors of the show that are very appreciated. They cover the cost of production in there. We will be back in a few moments, folks.
Updating plugins and themes shouldn't feel risky. That's why over 300,000 WordPress users trust WP Rollback. With just a click, you can safely roll back any plugin or theme. No manual file uploads and no downtime. And with WP Rollback Pro, you can download premium plugins and themes. Tools like Elementor, Gravity Forms, more. Track every rollback you do with detailed activity logs. Protect your workflow and take the stress out of updates. Learn more at wprollback.com.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Lifter LMS, the leading learning management system solution for WordPress. If you or your client are creating any kind of online course, training-based membership website, or any type of e-learning project, Lifter LMS is the most secure, stable, well-supported solution on the market. Go to lifterlms.com and save 20% at checkout with coupon code podcast20. That's podcast20. Enjoy the rest of your show.
We're coming back. We've had a fantastic discussion with Rob, the friend of the show. It's always great to have Rob back. But before we go into the second half, I want to point out we got some great deals from the sponsors, plus a curated list of the best WordPress plugins and services and technology for the power user, for the small agency, for the freelancer. To find all these goodies, go over to wp-tonic.com/deals, wp-tonic.com/deals, and you find all the goodies there. What more could you ask for, my beloved tribe? Probably a lot more, but that's all you're going to get on that page. I've made a career of disappointing. There we go, Rob. So over to you, Kirk. You can do the next question.
Well, you guys started getting into it a little bit about this idea of product market fit. And you had a YouTube video on like the five levels of product market fit that I watched, Rob. And I want to refer people to that. Search that out. I was making some assumptions about where I was in product market fit, but you broke it down. You broke it down by a percentage of churn, you know, MMR, and when I looked at the dollar amounts, I was like, ooh, maybe I'm not in stage three. Maybe I am in stage two, right? It was really quite telling the way that you described that. Could you give us just a little detail without having to redo a whole training from a YouTube video?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I tell you, I was listening to a podcast in the venture space. And I don't remember who it was, maybe like Lenny's podcast or something. And First Round Capital, someone from there was on it. And I'm not super familiar with them, but I have heard of him. And he had a framework for product market fit. And I started listening. And he's like, level one, nascent product market fit, level two, level three. And as he's going, I'm like, this is super interesting. None of this applies to my companies. Like this is such a venture backed, right? It's just a venture lens. And I'm like, this doesn't fit. So I sat down and I kind of started like talking to ChatGPT and I'm just like, bootstrap a product market fit. Let's think about this. And this is my limited experience of investing in 235 companies and starting my own and being in the, you know, whatever. So it's my lens, but I really was like stage one is pre-product market fit. It's when you're just flailing, churn is high, 5 to 10% or more, probably a few thousand MRR. And then you can get to weak product market fit, right? Churn's starting to come down 3 to 7% a month. And maybe you're doing up to, I don't know, $5,000 to $20,000. MRR, and then stage three is emerging. So it's a little further, and stage four is strong. And that's when you get up to about $1 million ARR, and then stage five is mature product market fit. Now, and that's $1 million and up, and your churn can be net negative at that point. It can be 0, 1, 2, 3% net. Now, a venture-backed, you know, a true venture capitalist would look at my numbers and say, those are toy businesses. Yeah. Those are not even real. But you know what? You get to, I know a founder who got to 3 million ARR, mostly bootstrapped, took some tiny seed money. And our check sizes for people know are, but usually between about 150 and 220,000. They're very small checks in the scheme of things. Got to 3 million.
They're small checks back. Unless you haven't got 200,000.
Unless you haven't. No, I know. Would have been a big check to me years ago, but sold for tens of millions of dollars. And so it is a toy business to a venture capitalist when they need, you know, Apple level, Facebook level, OpenAI level returns. But that founder is set generational wealth for him, and it returned millions of dollars to Tiny Seed. These are not toy businesses to me. So, anyways, that's, I really wanted to, I had never seen anything like this where there's these five stages or multiple stages, and it's kind of trying to get into growth, as you said, and churn, to try to bucket them and to say what it looks like and what you should be working on. I had never seen it, and I felt pretty strongly that I wasn't making this up. This is just what I see out there. So I hope that it helps people. And I put a YouTube video out, and I think we have a PDF of it someone can download somewhere.
Nice, nice. Over to you, Jonathan.
Yeah, like I was saying about this guy, I could remember his name, but he was talking about market fit, and he was saying, and you've talked about it, but he was saying that, you know, and we preach it on another podcast, me and Kurt, about course creators. I wouldn't even make a course unless I had a landing page and I actually could get some people to give me some money. And it's the same, he said, you know, don't sell it to your friends or people that like you, because they're just going to tell you what you want to, they don't want to hurt your feelings. You've got to get some people to actually give you some money for the idea, and then that's a good sign. So you did your own video on this about product market fit. Maybe you can give us some thought, your own thoughts about that.
Are you talking about like pre-selling, like trying to validate an idea?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's, look, some people, I hear them say, oh, validation. I validated it, like the experts say, and then it didn't work. Therefore, validation doesn't work. And it's like, no. Validation is never 100%. You cannot validate any idea to 100%. But right now, if you and I came up with, the three of us came up with an idea for a course or a book or a startup or a conference, we are about 0% validated that this is going to do anything. Maybe 5 or 10%, you know, if the three of us are pretty smart. All validation is, there's really two approaches that I've taken. And I've taken these approaches with multiple books, with conference, with Tiny Seed, with SaaS apps. I'm trying to think of what else, probably something else that I can't remember. But it's either a landing page or it is one-on-one customer prospect conversations. And usually I do both. So like before I launched Start Small, Stay Small, my first book, put up a landing page and said, this is the book for bootstrappers. If you want to build, if you're a developer, you want to build a company, don't need to raise venture capital, this is the book. And I got like 400 or 500 emails from people. I was like, okay, that's some validation. I didn't pre-sell it. I did go and write the book. And then I sold several hundred copies and it was good. Did the same thing for MicroConf. MicroConf in 2011 was just a landing page with some headshots. I got Heaton Shaw, Noah Kagan, myself and my co-host to, we put our headshots on the thing, picked a date, and then we put it up and said, are you interested? We didn't have a venue. We didn't have tickets. It was just email login or email opt-in. Same thing with Tiny Seed. An entire startup accelerator was just a landing page. You can go see it in Wayback Machine. And all it was me saying, venture funding doesn't help bootstrappers. I want to start something where funding can be bootstrapper friendly. I'm Rob Walling. This is why I should be doing this. Put your email in if you either want to invest or you're a founder. And that's all it was a landing page for like months. And I tweeted it, emailed the list, and then we raised fund one. Our first fund was 4.6-7 million. And that was raised mostly based on this landing page. So now landing pages aren't everything, but they are one signal that you can drive from social. And I used ads to drive to the drip landing page. I didn't do that with Tiny Seed. But then there are often one-on-one conversations to Jason Cohen. You've heard him, how he validated WP Engine, which was he did cold outreach to people on LinkedIn and then said, would you use a faster, you know, high-performant WordPress, more expensive WordPress hosting platform? And he got like 30 or 40 people to tell him yes. And that's when he went and built it.
Right. Over to you, Kurt. Was it me? I'm trying not to. I was told by a very popular influencer. See, Rob, I was told by a very popular influencer in the WordPress space that I interrupt too much. So I'm trying to change my ways.
You're doing great today.
I am. I'm trying. He was, like all things, he was partially correct, but he was. He was being his normal gracious self as well. There we go.
he's one of those. He's one of those hard love, right? What do they call that? Tough love. Tough he's love. A tough love person.
Tough love. Yeah.
He's a tough love person.
Yeah.
So you were talking about pre-selling the book, and then you talked about landing pages for this, that, and the other. But in reality, you're not really selling to consumers. Like almost everything you do is business to business, right?
Yeah.
Like I think about the book even. Like I don't think your book is marketed to soccer moms, right? It's marketed to people that want to grow a business or that they're in the business space.
Aspiring founders at least, yeah.
So talk to me about why you think consumer driven products and services are more what would you call that? Like they're less successful than business to consumer. I mean, business to business.
Yeah. Well, especially specifically with software, with SaaS. Because look, if you're gonna invent a widget and go on Shark Tank, a physical scrubbing something or other for your kitchen, go do that. Like people, you know, it's a lottery ticket, and some people do have really big successes with it. Or if you're gonna sell content for consumers like Dungeons and Dragons live streaming or whatever, a course on how to be a better DM. A dungeon master. Yeah, sure. No, go do that. That's fine. Info products for consumers. It's fine. It works. There's dating and there's health and there's working out. And, you know, there's all these how to make money online, that type of stuff. When I come in, when I see folks trying to launch SaaS to consumers, all I see is brutal.
It's going to be brutal, isn't it?
The churn is through the roof. I mean, I see churn 20% a month, 25% a month. It's like you're turning over your entire customer base every 4 months. Like this is not SaaS. It doesn't even qualify as SaaS in my mind. Price points, you know, everyone, what are consumers used to paying for SaaS? Like they complain about $12 for Netflix. I want to charge $100 or $1,000 a month. There's no consumer that's going to pay me that. And so as a result, all right, great. So I can charge like $9 a month for consumers or maybe hobbyists. Let's say a hobbyist has a podcast and I'm podcast hosting. I can charge like what, $14 a month, $20 a month. I can't charge $100 a month for a hobbyist podcaster. So the price points are so low, you can barely afford to market, right? Because you can't run ads. You can't hire someone to do biz dev. You can't hire a salesperson. You can't do demos. You have like, there's about 20 B2B SaaS marketing approaches that exist. I list them all in my book, SaaS Playbook. And if you are selling to consumers, you can do like four of them, right? It's like viral marketing and SEO and content. And there's like a couple, but you can't do most of them. So you're very limited on what you can do. Plus your churn's likely to be high. It's more fun potentially, or more sexy, or you have more of a relationship with it. Cause it's like, well, I'd be the user for this thing that does, you know, I'm trying to think of even consumer SaaS. There just aren't, like when I ask, I'll go on X Twitter and say like, there are approximately zero successful B2C SaaS companies. Name one. And people will be like Netflix. And it's like, that's not SaaS. That's a content play. You're not paying for software. If Netflix could hypothetically just send you a huge hard drive every month with all the videos on it and it's set at your house, that would work, right? You would pay $14 for that. All you want is the movies. That's not SaaS. And so everyone's in the SaaS and Spotify and this and that. And realistically, the only ones that I know of that are actually big and successful. Oh, and people will say like Dropbox. Dropbox, have you looked at their revenue? They're public. 80%+ of their revenue comes from businesses. Like the consumer revenue is a pittance. It's like 15-20%. The only ones that I know of are that actually work are like fitness trackers, you know, where you get like the Aura ring or whatever. And there was one other category and I forget what it even is now, but it's stuff like that. It's around like working out, exercise and such. Maybe some sports things, like some people with golf, you know, to track their golf, blah, blah, blah. But everything else is not, there really is not B2C SaaS at scale.
Well, yeah, but what about WP Engine? How would you classify? Because I'm on a much, much smaller scale with my little company, WP Tonic.
You're an SMB. Yeah, you're a small business.
Yeah, I'm trying to be a boutique hosting provider in the e-learning space. I'm getting some traction. It's been really brutal, though. But so how would you classify what Jason did with WP Engine?
You mean in terms of B2B versus B2C?
Because it seems a mix, doesn't it?
I don't know. Do you know a single consumer that has a website on WP Engine? It's all businesses. Like my wife is Dr. Sherry Walling. I think you've spoken with her. She is a solopreneur who hosts, I think she, does she even have WordPress anymore? She might be on Squarespace now. But when
you have to swear like that?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Sorry. Can you bleep that out for me? Yeah, I forget. Sometimes I get a little carried away. But when she had a WordPress site, she was on WP Engine. And you could say, well, isn't she a consumer? But no, she's paying for her business website, sherrywalling.com.
Business website.
Yeah, I'd say there's approximately zero consumer websites on WP Engine. If you're a consumer truly paying for a hobby website for Dungeons & Dragons or some game, you're going to go to what are the $4 a month hosts, like GoDaddy or something? Like, I don't even know what the bottom end of the market is, but that's where you're going to go as a consumer because you're so price sensitive.
Oh, I don't mind that because I've been nasty to GoDaddy. They're never going to sponsor me. So you can say whatever you like about GoDaddy because I've been nasty to them. But they're fine, but I agree with you. Sorry.
I think this drives back to a conversation Jonathan and I had this week, Rob, and that was, We were reviewing some SaaS products, and I don't want to mention names because God forbid they're in your little circles. But I'm seeing these horrific ads that are like, you don't need a website, you don't need courses anymore, you just need a mobile app, right? And then you get all these subscribers on your mobile app, or you need a private podcast. You know, more successful private podcasters make more money, you know, through the and my position with Jonathan was like, so they're selling business to business. They're selling the podcast thing. They're selling the mobile app thing. They're business to business. But the people that they're selling to, in my humble opinion, they don't have a prayer, because what average person is looking for another subscription or to pay for information that's otherwise free just by searching YouTube? Like, I don't see people. But then to your point, as you were talking, I thought trade magazines. Like, there are still aviation trade magazines, dentistry trade magazines, right? Like medical trade magazines. People still go to print and deliver them to offices and make a ton of money. And they'll pay a premium because that's information that's not generally, or you like, but that's business to business, right? Like if I run a dental office, if I run a hangar at an airport, right? I'm going to want that trade magazine. So I can... Your insight there really led me to think that it really is B2B. And as soon as you go the B2C angle, you put yourself at risk because there's no money. No one wants to pay for that at that level.
Especially subscription. So there are info product or info marketers or influencers that sell courses to consumers, and they have, you have to do it like Alex Ramosi, maybe. I think there's a lot of even that's like businessy stuff. But you know, the three big kind of information categories for consumers are dating and relationships, health and fitness. And I'm going to include sports in that because golf and fishing are part of that. You know, I'll lump all that in. And the third one is how to make money online. And I don't mean we talk about actual business stuff. I mean the biz ops, selling the dream thing where it's hey, I'm in a Maserati, right? Those do work, and people build up big audiences on YouTube or TikTok these days, or on Instagram. And you'd learn to kind of know, and trust the person. And then the person says, I have this course for $50 or $90 or whatever, or a membership, blah, blah, blah. That can work. The churn is very high if you do any type of subscription. If you do a one-time fee, people make a living at it. So it's not that it doesn't exist in info. It really doesn't exist in SaaS though. I just don't see it.
Yeah, it's super insightful. Over to you, Jonathan.
I'm going to be, because Kirk's being tactful, but as you know, Rob, I'm not. So basically, we were talking, because Kirk was quite insightful, because we were doing a review of Beehive, the newsletter platform, and they've introduced a lot of extra improvements, as they put them. It's well moving away from a newsletter. You know, they're throwing in podcasting, they're throwing in a website, they're throwing, and Kurt pointed out that's not a sign of strength. That's a sign that, in his opinion, that the core element of Beehive, that they've got this kind of marketplace and they've got mechanisms that can promote your newsletter to in a crowd and you get traction, might not be as effective as they're making out, because they're aiming at encroaching on other people's turf, you know, with all these extra elements. And I was a little bit more charitable than Kirk was, but I think he's probably right. What's your own thoughts when somebody, a company, dramatically starts not adding on core functionality to the core product, but they start adding stuff that seems to be outside the boundary of the original core product? Is this making any sense, Rob?
It is making sense. Here's the answer is, I don't know. It's one of two things. Yeah. They're either really smart and they're trying to get ahead of what's called the S-curve. The S-curve is that every product, no matter how good it is, it's going to grow, and then it's like an S, it's going to plateau. HubSpot, the core inbound marketing engine, did that. Salesforce, the core CRM, did that. WP Engine, the core hosting, like all these big companies, that happens. Apple, there's a reason you launch multiple products. So what you do is you then layer on that next product. Remember when HubSpot wasn't even a CRM, and then they added it as another product?
I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. They were all inbound marketing until 2011. They bought Performable, I think. That was landing pages. I don't know if that is here, but they started acquiring to you stack the S-curve. So Jason Cohen has a great article about this. Elephant Curve, I think. Type in Jason Cohen Elephant Curve or a smart elephant curve. It's the best article I've seen on it. I don't know the Beehive guys, and I don't know what their internal revenue or growth looks like. But
well, they got about $30 million in finance.
Mm-hmm. So they're either being smart and getting ahead of the S-curve, or they don't know what they're doing and they're just flailing, launching a bunch of stuff, trying to be the maker platform. Will it work? We don't know. Maybe they're.
Well, I don't think they. I think they know what they're doing. But who knows? Well, yep. Just, I don't. That's for sure. I'm just put. It's all conjecture, isn't it, Rob? Really, isn't it? Let's round it up. By the way, can you stay on for some extra bonus stuff, or do you have to be off on the hour?
I can.
Because Kurt does, because he's got another engagement. But let's do this one quick. And then, so if you could go back to your 20s and you could give yourself a little bit of advice, a little bit of a tip, what would you give yourself, Rob?
Become an influencer and make money online content. No, that's not what I would say. I think my biggest thing was, you know, the big thing is I saw venture capital and I wanted to do startups and I didn't see anyone doing it the way I wanted to. So I just went off on my own for years and I blogged about it and talked about it, but I just did my own thing. I didn't find a group, a community of like-minded people. I didn't even look. And there were some out there. Joel on Software, Business of Software forums were good. And then later I started my own, right? That's what MicroConf and Tiny Seed kind of sprang out of that in the podcast. But I think the biggest thing was I thought that I could do it all on my own and I kind of wanted to do it all on my own. Just one man, yeah. An island. And yeah. A whole community. I didn't want employees. I didn't want any of that. And so I would encourage myself back then, surround yourself with people who are doing it, who are positive. You know, my relatives were not entrepreneurs. I was actually discouraged from being an entrepreneur by friends and not so much family, but like friends and people around me. That wasn't helpful. What about finding actual people who are doing this maybe a little ahead of you? Where are they? Maybe they're listening to this show. Maybe they're at MicroConf. Maybe they're at a local event. But like, get around them and be in the network. You will learn so much more so much faster than if you try to do, you make every mistake on your own, which is effectively why it took me so long to get where I am.
It's always very strange, really, because I look at myself, because I am a little bit of a loner myself, but I think it's not my natural stance. I do like people, but I think because of my dyslexia and the way I was treated, I became a little bit of a loner, if that makes sense. And it's a bit like, I don't like really large groups. I prefer kind of a few friends around dinner. But on the other hand, I get pumped up about presenting to large groups. So it's all very contradictory. I can't even make sense in my own mind about myself. But I suppose there is some pattern to it,
There's a difference between those two, right? Because you and I, we could be on this podcast and say, oh, there's 5, 10, 15,000 people listening. And it's like, but I'm an introvert.
I wish there was. Well, actually, my numbers even impressed Kurt, actually, niche podcast.
But being on stage or being on a podcast like this, I don't think requires extroversion. I'm not extroverted, but I obviously record a lot of content. But being in a room with a lot of people, there's a different energy flow and it's like back and forth conversation, which is different than just this interview.
When you're presenting to a large group, because I quite like it, I get pumped up. As long as I've practiced enough, I get pumped up. Do you get pumped up about it?
I do. I used to get really, really nervous. And then at a certain point that flipped and the nerves actually are excitement and energy. And if I practice a talk, let's say twice before I give it, like in my hotel room or whatever, the best version of the talk I give is always on stage because of the energy. And it used to be the opposite. There was the worst version because I was so nervous that I was like deer in the headlights. And I'm like, why did I stumble? Why didn't I say this? Now when I'm on stage, it's like it's delivered with the most confidence and it has the best points that I pull from nowhere all of a sudden because I'm on the spot. And that's a cool place to go to. But it's purely repetition. At least it was for me.
Right. So let's end the show, but we have some bonus content. You'll be able to watch the whole show plus the bonus content on the WP Tonic YouTube channel. But Kirk, what's the best way for people to find out more about you and what you're up to, Kirk?
I'm on LinkedIn almost every day, and I'm the only Kurt Von Onen on LinkedIn. So when you search me and you find me, you know you got me. And then Mañana Nomás is for the company stuff. If you need something, just look us up on mañananomás.com or on our socials.
And thanks for being such a great co-host, Kurt. You know, your contributions to the show is much appreciated. Rob, what's the best way for people to find out more about your thoughts and your ideas, Rob?
You know, if people are into podcasts, search for Startups for the Rest of Us, wherever podcasts are served, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the places. If you're more into YouTube, head to youtube.com/microconf, and that's where I put out a YouTube video every other week. I have like 400 on that channel now. And those are probably the easiest ways.
It's a great podcast. You learn a lot, folks. We're not having a show next week. We're having a little break. But we will be back in December. We've got some great guests in December. But we're not around next Thursday. But we will be back soon. We'll see you soon, folks. Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening. We really do appreciate it. Why not visit the Mastermind Facebook group? And also to keep up with the latest news, click wp-tonic.com/newsletter. We'll see you next time.